Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Thursday, August 18th, 2022. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. And thanks to the tireless efforts of Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice, these tools are available absolutely free on the internet at whyagain.org. If you go to that website and click on the Start Here link in the upper left-hand corner, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? That chapter of the book contains a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. It's a tool I've been using to great effect for 18 years now to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships, and to turn any negative emotional experience into part of the infallible guidance system that each and every one of us has been given. I'm prompted to say there that that infallible guidance system is our emotional energy system. And the essence of this teaching is that if we're in a state where we're having a negative thought about someone, ourselves or somebody else, or a negative emotion active in our minds, we can instantly know three things. It's a lie or based in a falsehood. It's an old tape playing. It's not about what's going on in the present moment. And if I take action based on it or sit and pour energy into those negative thoughts or emotions, it's just going to make my life worse, not better. If I rationalize or justify my emotions, I make myself hopelessly stuck. And if I use my emotional experience as part of this alarm system, guidance system, it can make for a much better, more enjoyable, more rewarding life. You can also download the actual worksheet process itself. It's a simple PDF file. Click the link, download it, print it off, copy it as often as you'd like, and use it over and over again, absolutely free. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words, Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness. And before you're done typing the word forgiveness, you'll see the glowing heart icon. If you choose to tap on that, it will let you download a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet, an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. We're hoping people do that soon and often because primarily it leads to better life results for most of us to engage those tools. And secondarily, it is one of the mechanisms that prompts questions, answers, testimonials. And if you have any of those to share with us, please give us a call at 563-999-3581. And if you call that number and press 1, it'll put a little question mark by your phone number. And I guess these days it puts a little icon of a hand by your phone number. And I will turn on the microphone and announce you by your area code. Alternatively, if you're listening to this through the archives, you can send us an email if you have comments or questions or testimonials. You can email me at tjh@mindshifters-academy.org, or you can email Jeannie at jeanie@whyagain.org. That's whyagain.org. So we have time, and I like to remind people during these shows, even if I'm in the middle of reading from the Way of Mastery or in some part of a monologue, feel free to call that number, 563-999-3581, and press 1 on your phone. I will either turn on your microphone immediately or when it seems appropriate to the flow of the show. Last year we did A Course in Miracles, and we had a bunch of people who were following the show specifically because we were doing A Course in Miracles. And they aren't following the show anymore, but this year we're doing The Way of Mastery, and there are different people who are following the show for The Way of Mastery. And it's always fascinating to me which tools people find resonate with them and most valuable for them. And that's all we're interested in, is what works for you. What tool might you step into that can help you realize the truth, as The Way of Mastery calls it, the truth that is true always, the truth that your source energy, whatever gave rise to you, can never be separate from you, nor you separate from it, that you are connected, that you are loved, loving, and lovable forever, that your one true purpose in life is to extend the good, the holy, and the beautiful, that all of these various ways to say the more you can become consciously, actively aware, Dr. Michael Rice's phrase for it was total, perfect, conscious, active, present love. And I made the top cap acronym for that, T-O for total. Perfect, conscious, active, present love. And the essence of the Course in Miracles and the Way of Mastery and Diedrich Wolczak's teaching, which is based on his understanding of the Course in Miracles, and all of these other teachers, the essence of it is that you are always total, perfect, active, present love. You are not very often conscious of that fact. So in Dr. Michael Rice's phrase, total, perfect, conscious, active, present love, the real thing we have to work on is the conscious part. We have to learn to bring our conscious awareness out of the conditionings of our culture, out of the mindset that we've interpreted and inherited from our family after years of trauma and people who are being taught rigid thoughts and beliefs or religions or rituals, and they've lost the essence of the meaning of those spiritual teachings, and they've gotten into the ritual, and they're valuing the ritual above the essence. And so the goal of a work like this is to help you wake up to bring conscious awareness to your true nature. Conscious awareness to the fact that you are total, perfect, active, present love. That you are always connected to your source. You can't be separate from that which gave rise to you. That all creation is connected. And if you can use the focusing ability that you've been given dominion over to focus your mind energy in a particular direction, and if you can use it to focus on the truth that is true always, that you didn't create yourself and you don't know when you were created and therefore you don't know much about anything, about what truly matters in life, and so you can ask to be shown by something that's more integrated, more able to access wisdom, more free from the conditionings of culture and language and the limitations of the five senses, if you keep asking to be shown from one of those sources that is not limited to the input of your five senses or the cultural conditioning, you can be ushered into an experience of yourself and the flow of life that goes beyond your comprehension each new heartbeat, that goes beyond the ability to be described in words. So that's why from the very beginning, the Way of Mastery has been presenting us with various exercises that we can engage in so that we can have an experience of ourselves and the flow of creation in, through, as, and around us that's very different than what we get when we rely on our conscious logical mind, or as the Way of Mastery would say, the trivialities which have been shoved into our intellect, and we rely on that as our primary interface with life. So lesson 19 is titled, Surrender the Dream of the Dreamer. And we started reading the first few pages yesterday, and we left off right after the text has read that because this is simply the truth, it must mean that where you perceive justification for anything less than peace, it must mean that you've already decided in the deeper part of your mind to maintain this root or core misperception. Right? Because your mind has already been healed of illusion. But you can still create misperception. That is, you're still attempting to perceive yourself as having accomplished the impossible. That is, to have separated yourself from the mind of the Creator. The mind that is surrendered looks out upon all things and quietly says within itself, there has been only the creation. I am created of that. The source of my being, the source of my reality, rests in surrender into that, the source of all creation. And that alone. Close quotes. The mind that is surrendered, yet walks in your world as long as the body lasts, and it is often completely unrecognized by others around it. For others still see a body, and therefore they assume that there's an individual in that body, an ego, that's operating as though it were separate and separated from everyone else. When the mind is surrendered, you could say that the body walks as an empty shell and is merely awaiting to be informed by the intelligence, by the wisdom, by the love of creation itself. And when the love of creation does not inform you or ask you to move or take action, then that body simply rests and does nothing. That is why the final state of awakening is completely incomprehensible to the languages of your world, since your languages are based on the very thought of separation itself. That is why when we speak of peace, we speak of a peace that passes all understanding. Another reason is because the understanding we have is that we can only achieve peace when we get this and that and that's in place and this person is nice to us and we've got that money in the bank and we fix the roof dripping, and that's when I have peace. Trained to believe that we only achieve peace when we arrange these things in the outside environment in a certain way and when we can cajole or convince or seduce or threaten or manipulate other people to be and do what we want them to be and do. So the concept that I can tap into a space within me, an existence, an awareness of an existence within me, in the middle of the chaos of family drama, in the middle of the chaos of a war zone, that I could tap into that space within me and experience peace is completely incomprehensible. That I could have peace even when the bank account is reading zero and people are knocking on the door or ringing the phone trying to collect money from me that I don't have. That I could be at peace in that scenario is incomprehensible. That's one of the reasons they call it the peace that passes all understanding. Many great teachings have said, if you think you have peace because the bank account is full and because so-and-so is treating you nicely and because you've got the stereo you want, if your peace is dependent upon any of those outside factors, you have no peace at all. What you have is fear that you might lose those things that is instantaneously created as soon as you acquire those things that you think are going to give you the peace. This is why teachers like Abraham talk about tuning into what it is that you want and then understanding why you want it. You want the Mercedes car. You want, you know, the new fancy super computerized Ford Bronco. You want the attractive partner. You want somebody to come as a white knight on a horse and you know, ask you to marry him or her and take you out of your abusive family. You want X, Y, and Z thing. Think about why you want them. And Abraham says, you want those things or those interactions with people because of how you think it's going to make you feel. And the problem with it, as Guy Finley points out, is that if you go out and acquire that thing, then as soon as you have it and you have that moment of peace, the next moment you've got fear that you might lose that thing and your peace is going to go with it. Your comfort, your safety, your assurance of that you're right is going to go with it if you lose that thing. So Abraham says, so here's a much better practice than going out and acquiring things or using the law of attraction to bring things to you. A much better practice is go inside yourself and recognize how you are creating your emotion in each new present moment and work to create the emotion that you think you're going to have when you get this or that thing or person or situation. Then, if you still have a desire for that external thing, go out and get it, because then you'll be free from the fear that if you lose this thing, you'll lose your happy emotion or your peace, because you had the peace even before. You had the happy emotion even before you acquired this external thing or this external relationship. So the text was reading, this is why we speak of peace. We speak of the peace which is beyond all understanding. For the peace that you can understand in the languages of your world is conditional peace, the kind you create when two warring nations' leaders sit down in suits and ties and forget the death count and the destroyed villages, and they sign some document with a pen. They put on a front, and they smile for the pictures. And then they assume, and they teach everybody else to assume, that now there's peace. And then each one goes back and secretly continues to build weapons of defense and attack that are sure to come from the other side sooner or later, from who they perceive as an enemy. The text goes on and says, peace cannot be bargained for. It is not the result of compromise. Peace comes only when any mind surrenders unconditionally the dream of the dreamer itself, so that there is only the creation and creation's creation. We have shared with you before that creation is one, the Christ mind. That's the only creation. And that mind is not in the body. It is not a particular form and certainly does not belong to any personal entity. Now the text reads, quote, I was never, quote, the Christ, close quotes, as though you are not the Christ. Like you, I was a temporary modification of eternal energy, an outpicturing of thought, a mental thought held in the mind, which learned to surrender the misperception of the dreamer and to become informed only by the Christ mind. Only that mind was present, and yet it could not be touched through the body. That is why my crucifixion had no effect whatsoever on me. It merely sped up the process whereby the body was dissolved away as an idea. So this is a critical piece for this work. And anybody who's got any kind of a Christian history and any kind of religious history and the people who've talked about their God, their God made man, their Jesus, the Son of God, Jesus, the Christ, etc. This work offers the invitation for each person who comes across this teaching to learn to tap into the same dynamics of consciousness and awareness and expansion and wisdom that Yeshua, the person Yeshua, that many would call Jesus, that he tapped into. And the quote, I'm going to read this last paragraph again, that tries to clear this up, and yet one more time, say it another way. I was never, quote, the Christ, close quotes, as though you are not. This is Yeshua speaking, right? This is a book that's ostensibly channeled from the consciousness that was Yeshua 2,000 some years ago that has come back to people over the decades and centuries and given guidance and been a mentor and a way shower and channeled books and channeled readings. And this entity is saying, I was never the one, as though you are not the one. This Christ mind is a state of experience. It's not a physical body or a personality. The text reads, like you, I was a temporary modification of eternal energy. I was an outpicturing of a thought, a mental thought held in the mind. And I learned to surrender the misperception of the dreamer. And I became informed only by the Christ mind. And it was a transition over time that he learned to do, as he's talked about through these various lessons. He was given some of the various lessons, the very same lessons and exercises that this body of work is suggesting for us. It was a process of awakening for him. It can be a process of awakening for you. You were never separate from your source. You have access to the Christ mind. All that's needed is to identify and remove everything that's unlike the Christ mind, everything that thinks it knows, everything that wants to judge, everything that has a negative emotion attached to it. Give it up. Cancel your desire for it. Dismantle your identification with it, ask to be shown something else, and you can tap into the very mind of consciousness, elevated consciousness, that Yeshua tapped into. I was never the Christ, as though you were not. Like you, I was a temporary modification of eternal energy. I was an outpicturing of thought. I was a mental thought held in the mind. and I learned to surrender the misperception of the dreamer, and I became informed by the Christ mind. Only the Christ mind was present, and yet it could not be touched through the body. That is why my crucifixion had no effect on me whatsoever. It merely sped up the process whereby the body was dissolved away as an idea. This work has said over and over again, whatever begins in time, ends in time, that your body is a very temporary communication device, that it is quite advantageous for you to consider what is it you would like to communicate, what is it that you truly value, and spend your time, your intelligence, your money, and your energy communicating that. In this work, it's recommended that you choose to share only loving thoughts. And in that way, you teach only love. You teach the truth of what is. The text goes on and says, the world is innocent. That's the heading of the next section in this lesson 19. The world is innocent. Beloved friends, come now in your understanding to change how you use consciousness. Take a pause with us to remember the truth. The world that you look upon is innocent. The cause of the world is not found in the world, but only in the thoughts held within your mind. You remain perfectly free to choose to perceive differently. You remain free at all times to see that you are not the victim of circumstance, that you are not the victim of a relationship, a career, or being born into a certain nation. You are never the victim of anything, since nothing within an illusion holds the power to truly have any effect on you. You are the one who remains free to assume responsibility for the domain of your mind. You are the one who is free to simply say, quote, Creator, nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done, close quotes. Now, I can hear parts of my own mind resonating as I read this, saying things like, what, this is crazy. There's a huge difference. What about the five-year-old who's got arthritis so bad that she can't even walk and she's got to have a wheelchair and she doesn't even live to 12 years old and then she dies and has all of this pain and discomfort? And what about somebody who's, you know, just trying to live their life the best they can, and all of a sudden war breaks out. And people they've never known, people they've never talked to, people they've never done anything to start shooting and bombing their town. So parts of my own mind, still, after all these years of reading this work, come up with some of these thoughts. And it makes me think about people like Viktor Frankl, who was in a concentration camp in the Second World War, and he chose for love. And another person, they called him Wild Bill, who was in one of those concentration camps, whose story I learned when I read Pierre Pradervan's book, The Gentle Art of Blessing. And when they liberated the camps, and they started doing these interviews with these people trying to decide where they should go and how they could help them, they assumed that this guy they called Wild Bill, because they couldn't say his last name, I think he was Polish descent, he was so strong and healthy and vigorous that they assumed that he had just arrived at the camp. But when they interviewed him, they found out that, I think it was been 7 years he'd been there. He'd been there for years. And they said, well, how could this be? What is your story? And here was this guy. He was an attorney in the ghetto in Poland, and the Nazis came in and lined up his family and shot his entire family right in front of him. And he begged to be shot, put me out of my misery, let me go with my family. And they said, no, you're too valuable. You speak several different languages. And so as an attorney, he said, I understood what hate does to people. I had seen it in my practice. And he said, I just made the decision at that time that I will not hate. If I've got 5 minutes left to live or 50 years left to live, I will not give in to hate. And so he kept choosing for love. And even though he was in the same conditions that left most other people disease-ridden and emaciated, he maintained a level of vitality that they couldn't explain because he chose for love. There's another story. There's the Nelson Mandela story. 20-some years in prison, political prisoner, refuses to hate his captors. When he's finally released, leads a nationwide love fest to quit hating each other and to overturn apartheid. Here's Roger McGowan on death row in Texas for 20-some years for something he didn't do. Chooses to become a spiritual teacher. Says things like, there's a book by Pierre Pradervan that is constructed mostly from the letters that correspondences he's had back and forth with Roger McGowan. These 5 points right in the beginning from this book, from this guy in a 6-foot by 6-foot by 10-foot cell on death row for 20-some years, where he's actively being abused by the guards. And he says, love is the fundamental law of the universe, the reply to every situation, our reason for existing, the essence of what we are. Love is easy. Hate is a difficult role to play. Point number two, everything that happens in life is an opportunity to learn. Life is a school of higher learning. Point number three, we can refuse to be victims and take total responsibility for our lives. Even happiness is a choice to be made, whatever the circumstances of one's existence. Point number four, God, infinite love, provides a field of infinite possibilities so each of us can create a life that is perfect for us. Point number five, everyone creates their own reality, essentially through their way of looking at, interpreting events, people, and situations. So that's in response to what part of my brain was doing when I read this last paragraph from The Way of Mastery, Lesson 19. You remain perfectly free to choose to perceive differently. You remain free at all times to see that you are not a victim of the circumstance, not the victim of a relationship, not the victim of a career or being born into a certain nation. You are never the victim of anything, since nothing within an illusion holds the power to truly have any effect on you, your essence, your spiritual essence. You are the one who remains free to assume responsibility for the domain of your mind. You are the one who is free to simply say, quote, Father, nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done, close quotes. The text goes on and asks, and what will does the Father have, save that you be happy by returning to the peace that forever passes all understanding? What could your Creator will for you but that you awaken from the dream that there is nothing in the world that can add value to you? And there is someone, there, and that there is someone, some career, some location, some whatever you have, whatever have you, that can actually add substance to your being. It can't be. And better than this, to become freed from the perception that the lack of someone, the lack of something, the lack of some career or some location, some form of any kind, that it could detract from your being, from your perfect power of union with your Creator. So, over and over again, the great spiritual teachings say, you are whole and complete just as you are. Nothing can be added, nothing of value can be added unto you, and nothing of true value can be taken from you. And this reminds me of, we had a support group a number of years ago where someone was joining the group when we were having this kind of a lesson come up. And she chimed in and said, well, now I know this is all baloney because I just had somebody rip me off for $75,000. And we let her talk for a bit and then pointed out the fact that this work isn't saying no one can take anything from you. This work is saying no one can take anything of true value from you, and no one can add anything of true value to you because you are a spark of the divine mind. You are a miracle of creation expressing in form. You have the energy of creation moving in, through, as, and around you each moment. You, your consciousness, which gave rise to your physical body, is a miracle beyond miracles. It's far more enticing, wondrous, beautiful than anything you're ever going to see outside of you in nature. You are part of that flow of life that you call nature, and you're every bit as magnificent as the Grand Canyon or the most magnificent sunset or sunrise, or the most beautiful animal you've ever seen with all its vibrant colors. So the idea here is that nothing of value can be at true value can be added unto you, and nothing of true value can be taken from you. And that the creation itself has only the desire that you awaken to the peace that passes all understanding, which is your true nature and is your inheritance. The text goes on then and says, peace then comes from a decision that is put into practice over time, in which the world is released. Released from what? Released from your belief that it should somehow be for you the conduit whereby you gain good feelings, love, peace, wisdom, ideas, comradeship, and even brother or sisterhood. The world is not there to provide you with these things. You're there as the conduit to bring the creative energy into expression in the world. The world is not the conduit whereby you gain good feelings. You have access to that inside of yourself. These texts, these exercises, these proposed experiences are designed to usher you into a direct conscious relationship with that and then have you extend that good, the holy, and the beautiful in every interaction you have with everyone and everything around you. The text goes on and says, detachment does not mean avoidance. But it does mean disidentification with a mistaken idea. All suffering stems from this identification of the deep mind or the soul with the forms that pass as outpicturings in this illusion. That's pretty important. All suffering. What is all suffering? All suffering stems from this. that we have an identification of the deep mind or the soul with the forms that pass as out picturings in the illusion. We only suffer when we buy into the illusion of pain and suffering and separation and the illusion or the belief that people and things outside of us can bring us value, can bring us peace, can bring us safety and security. The text goes on and says, the belief that loss is possible and also that gain is possible. There can only be the recognition of what is true through the practice of extending the good, the holy, and the beautiful. So detachment does not mean avoidance. But it does mean learning to release the identification with mistaken ideas. All suffering stems from this following identification of the deep mind or the soul with the forms that pass as out picturings in the illusions. If I think I am my body, if I think I am my thoughts about myself, if I think my true nature is the fact that I worked this hard and I helped build this building and I got this degree or I saved up this money and bought this house, if I think that that's my value, I have bought into, I have identified with the false ideas in the illusion of the physical world. I buy into the belief that loss is possible and that gain is possible. When we've just been through it, you're whole and complete just the way you are. There's nothing of value that can be added unto you, and there's nothing of value that can be taken from you. The essence is there can only be recognition of what is true through the practice of extending the good, the holy, and the beautiful. How can you extend the good, the holy, and the beautiful unless you first recognize that the good, the holy, and the beautiful is what gave rise to you? It's your true essence, and you're a conduit for it, and then you can extend it. But if you don't recognize that, if you don't bring conscious awareness to this total, perfect, active, present love that you are, if you don't turn total, perfect, active, present love into total, perfect, conscious, active, present love, you can't extend the good, the holy, and the beautiful. The text goes on and says, the end of illusion is very near when the mind reaches this following point. When any mind looks out upon its creations that it has attempted to make of itself and finds all of it lacking, that something is missing, and when that mind simply decides to withdraw the value it has placed upon the world, and that mind rests into the simple desire to be with creation, then heaven is but a step away. And that final step is taken by creator, by creation, by your creator for you. This is where Guy Finley says, every attempt you've ever made to reach enlightenment, to find God, to get back into union with your creator, must fail. Why? So that you finally give up trying to do it all by yourself and you ask to be shown, and then your creator takes that last step for you. Your creator finds you. Your creator gets through the barriers that you've erected to keep this dream of separation active in your mind. The text goes on and says, the dream of separation has been your responsibility. When you reach that point of collapsing or surrendering, you enter into the stage of restoration or salvation. And that is in the hands of your creator. When restoration has been completed and the mind no longer seeks to journey out into the fields of illusion, but simply rests empty at one with its creator, then creation can begin anew. And co-creation is in the hands of both you and your creator. The only difference is that you are no longer a separate being, like a gnat shouting at the universe demanding things be done your way, but rather you are empty. You are the paradox of all paradoxes, for you are filled and only Christ abides. Yet not you lives, but only that one. Even the arising and passing away of the body are of no concern for you. You merely rise in the morning and say, quote, Creator, how would you have me be present this day? Close quotes. And then something else informs your steps and your decisions. You're no longer identified with the fruit of your action. You are no longer concerned with how it may look or how it may compare to somebody else's action. You merely abide where you are, doing what you're doing and offering it freely because you're no longer attached to it. Peace is the essence of the message that we would share with you in this lesson. As a temporary resting period from the work that we have been doing in the way of transformation, rest assured there is much more to be done. For when the mind is surrendered, resistance dies to the very extension of creation. And that mind no longer seeks to leave any dimension whatsoever. For where would it go? It merely becomes one willing to enact whatever is being extended to it from the mind of creation as a way of being involved with the extension of love, with the extension of the creative flow itself. That requires then learning how to use consciousness differently. But it is all predicated on a return to peace. That is why, above all things, your responsibility is to enter into surrender, to let the tiny mad idea of a separate self be dissolved entirely from the mind, so that there is only the mind of Christ. Now, again, this is a whole bunch of words, and the word is not the thing. And when you usher yourself into the kind of experience that they're suggesting here, you won't have any words to describe it to someone else. And when you get there and you spend more and more time in that space of surrender and knowing and allowing, the people around you are not going to be able to see a physical difference. You will have a different experience. Your life will start to unfold differently. And yet, you won't have words for it. You won't need words for it. You won't be caught up in the idea that you've got to communicate it verbally in a certain pat answer to someone. You're going to be living in the question. You're going to be accessing wisdom rather than possessing it. You're going to have an experience of yourself as connected to everyone and everything. And yet, you'll seem very normal. One of the things that this work points out, and a lot of people talk about, it sounds like that this is a prescription for hiding away in a cave or closing yourself off in your own closet and withdrawing from the world. But the essence of this teaching is that the more we do these experiences, these exercises, and then have these experiences, the more we understand there is an intelligence and a wisdom and a creative flow that would use our abilities and talents to its benefit. we end up becoming far more active, but it's not us doing the intellectual processing and figuring out what we need to do. We're just responding to the impulse, to the guidance, to the wisdom that we've accessed. And we turn our energies over to be used by life, by the flow of life, by God, by light, by love, by Jesus, whatever you want to say. Something outside my conscious logical mind. And I trust that whatever unfolds in my life is perfect just the way it is. And instead of fighting against it or resisting it, I'm actively allowing and surrendering to it in the moment. That means I get access to a lot more of it, and I ask, what's mine to do here? And then in the flow of life, I see a myriad of possibilities I don't see when I think I'm right and this person's wrong and it's settled and there's not going to be any argument, and if somebody argues with me, I'm going to smack them one and I'll take this to court and I'll do this and that. I don't get to see anything other than that tiny vision that I'm constructing that says I'm right and the other person is wrong. My view, my field of view, has collapsed into just a few centimeters. And the more angry I get, the more scared I get, the more sad I get, the more myopic, the more microscopic my view becomes. But if I release those negative emotions, if I release my identification with the thoughts about me being right and other people being wrong, if I breathe and soften the body, my field of view expands exponentially. And I get to see far more of life and possibilities and intricacies and interweavings of energy fields. And then what I do is far better informed from the truth of life in the moment. It's not limited to being informed by all of the beliefs that I've created and pour my mind energy into. So that's our reading for today from Lesson 19 in the Way of Mastery. We'll continue again tomorrow. Today is a Thursday, so I imagine we will probably finish the first read-through of Lesson 19 tomorrow. And I've had more than one person now ask me about the exercises in Lesson 18 and the suggestion has been made that I make an audio file of just the steps in that exercise that begin with sitting in the chair for 5 minutes as the Christ and then coming to open eyes meditative space and letting whatever comes into my awareness as the flow of life and creation, letting it be there and have me embrace it and have me become aware of all the judgments and history I have with that item or that person or that thought pattern. And I let all of that go. And then I just further embrace it just as it is. And then that text reads, and then bless it, which is basically the same as embracing it, allowing it, and dismantling my perceptions about it from the past and the present moment, which is what they call the process of forgiveness. So we'll see if that work gets done in the next few days. And if it does, I'll announce it in the show. And it'll get posted over on the mindshiftersacademy.org website, probably on the educational materials page, where I've most recently added the audio of me reading the forgiveness patter, which some have already said is quite useful. Some people are finding that they just play that and breathe and soften and do their EFT tapping, even if they're not in the middle of a worksheet process, and they're finding benefit with that. So we've got about 5 minutes left. We have time for a quick question or a comment, 563-999-3581. Or you can type your question or comment in the chat room, and we'll get ready to breathe and soften and have our second hour today with Michael and Jeannie. And for those that might be interested, I believe Jeannie has said that next week we're going to be playing the files from the Aramaicisms, which was a joint endeavor between Dale Ellen Hoffman and Dr. Michael Rice back in 2014 or 2015. And it's a four-hour video that's available for people to purchase, but they're going to use that as audio files for next week while they're on vacation. And I highly recommend it. I believe on Friday next week we'll probably play the, as a follow-up to that, we'll probably play the recording of my interview with Dale Ellen Hoffman. And that'll be a good week next week. It'll be the usual Way of Mastery in the first hour of the show, and then the Aramaicisms and Dr. Michael Rice talking with Dale Ellen Hoffman about wisdom from the ancient Aramaic language. So you might want to tell your friends about that or get ready to enjoy that yourself next week. I'm scrolling through my text trying to figure out where that text is from Jeannie Rice. So I will remind us all that we have a support group tonight, 6:30 to 9 p.m. Central Time. It's absolutely free to join. All the information you need to tap into that is available on the MindShiftersAcademy.org website. Please remember there's a separate login information page for Tuesday and a separate page for Thursday, as we run two groups a week in an effort to keep it reasonably secure. We have different login numbers for each day. It's free to join. We always welcome people, regardless of their money. If you want to donate, you can. And if you aren't available, but you think somebody else might be interested in that, please pass the information along. It's MindShiftersAcademy.org website. That support group format has been running in person until the coronavirus restrictions hit for 19 years, and now for online it's been going for at least 8 years, maybe 9 years now, through Zoom on Thursday nights. And now because of coronavirus, it's available online Tuesdays and Thursday nights. So I will remind us all that we come from love. We're made of this stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. Welcome, Jeannie Rice.
Thank you, Dr. Tim. Appreciate you.
You're very welcome and all deserving. Right. Have a great show.
Thank you. So welcome, everybody, to the second hour of Mind Shifters Radio. And today is Thursday, 2022. And our call-in number is 563-999-3581. And press 1, and that puts you in the queue to talk to us. And we would love to hear your comments and questions, because that makes this your show. And we've got some people that are supposed to call in today, so we're looking forward to having questions and taking the conversation in the direction that you want to take it instead of us doing a monologue. And we appreciate your time. While we're waiting on Michael to dial in, I'll direct you to our website, which is whyagain.org, whyagain.org. And you can click on the Start Here button or scroll down and click on the bullseye in the middle of the page. And both of those will take you to the same place where you'll find all the worksheets and different things. We are actually heading Saturday morning on our first vacation in 5 years, so we're excited about that. But the first stop that we're going to make is a place about 3.5 hours from here in Virginia, and it's called Woodruff's Cafe. And back in 2017, the Unity of Roanoke, doing a series of workshops, and the young lady who did the music on that Sunday morning had taken her class, I think it was fourth grade class, to this Woodruff's Cafe, and beautiful music, beautiful song. But anyway, we're going to stop and visit her again. We hadn't been there since 2017, and it's just a little tiny cafe, probably not as big as most people's kitchen. And the mother has since passed, but when we were there before, I think she was 103 maybe at the time when we were visiting.
Yep.
And fabulous. Yeah, so welcome, Michael. So we're going to stop and visit them, and we're going to pick up some. We asked them this morning if they could make us some pies made with monk fruit instead of sugar, and they agreed. So we are going to stop by there Saturday morning and pick up pies to take with us and visit, spend some time with the family. So we're looking forward to that. Welcome, Michael.
That's going to be really cool. And the thing that really clicked, and we actually contacted her once again because she had done a piece of music. She teaches in an upper-class neighborhood at a school of, was it grade four, Jeannie, if I remember correctly?
I believe so. I'm looking up the song right now on their website. There's actually, yeah. We don't have the music itself, but I do have the words. And there was an article that the newspaper had written up on them. So I'm looking that up as we speak.
It was a class of wealthy kids. And together, after visiting this little pie shop, the kids wrote a song called
That's All You Need.
That's All You Need.
That's All You Need. And yeah. I just found it.
You want to share the words with us? It's powerful. Put it in the context that these are kids who have their, you know, their fancy phones and their fancy shoes and their, you know, their $100 cardigans and, you know, on and on and on. And their learning was expressed in this song. And we're hoping to get the music to it. She was planning back then to have it recorded. And we have attempted to get it from her a couple of times. So we're trying again. I'm going to call into her. Is she going to share the words?
I do. Okay. It says, in Elon, Virginia, on a winding country road, there's a simple corner store with a story to be told. I don't know if I can read it.
Go for it. Breathing with you, sweetie.
Oh. A little slice of heaven with mountains all around, an orchard up the road where apples can be found. Inside are little tables and lots of wooden chairs. Not too many mat, but no one really cares. The walls are filled with pictures, some of family, some of friends, and yummy apple pie that we highly recommend. And then the chorus is, that's all you need, that's all you need. Be happy, give thanks for the simple things. If you do, you'll find the joys it brings. You might even find that's all you need. On a bench in the corner, a Bible by her side, centenarian Miss Woodruff always wears a smile. She'll tell you lots of stories, days of long ago. Every time she tells them, you'll be sure to know. Her husband built the store, built it up by hand, something he could call his own there on that land. His father was the son of a slave set free. The store would be the start of their new destiny. The corner has seen a lot of change all along the way. Things are not the same as they were yesterday. For 30 years, a grocery store, folks would come on by, and if they were in need, the Woodruffs would provide. The children at the bus stop would come in from the storm and wait with Mrs. Woodruff. She always kept them warm. Folks drove for miles to meet her and have pie.
And have pie. And listen to the stories.
And listen to the stories of the days gone by. She rode her daddy's mule 1 mile to get the mail, churned butter as a chore, fetched water in a pail. A tick bed made of wheat, a feed sack for a dress, one orange each for Christmas, and still they all felt blessed. Santa brought one baby doll that three sisters had to share. Seven brothers shared a toy and played without a care. You listen to the stories and think that things were tough, but she'll be quick to tell you that they always had enough. We took a fourth grade field trip to learn about the store, but in the end we realized that we learned so much more. We found a slice of heaven, and it wasn't in the pie. It was in the Woodruff story and the love that they inspire. That's all you need. That's all you need. Be happy. Give thanks for the simple things. If you do, you'll find the joy it brings, and you might even find that that's all you need.
And, of course, that chorus was repeated several times throughout the song. Powerful lesson that these wealthy children learned. When they saw a little bit about how the other half lives and had happiness with the simple things they had. So, quite powerful. Quite an inspirational teacher.
So we're excited to go and see them again.
Yes, I'm trying to think, were there four sisters that worked in the store?
Yes, I believe there was. A mother and either three or four. You've got a lot of static there. Either three or four sisters.
And one of the things that they did as we sat and talked with Mrs. Woodruff is girls came out and Mrs. Woodruff at 104 led them in a song for us. So they sang a cappella. I don't remember the song they sang, but it was just pretty sweet interaction with folks that were just one generation away from slavery. Mrs. Woodruff's dad was a slave, was one of the first landowners in that area. Just still carrying on a successful business, and we're looking forward to having a sugar-free apple pie, and seeing as how we're on vacation, we're going to do a chocolate cream pie, too. So we'll have a taste for each of you. That's all you need.
Right. It's probably more than we need. But anyway,
yeah, we're on vacation.
You already have a hand up.
Well, let's go for it.
All right. It's 770. I think it's Michael. Welcome.
Thank you, Jeannie.
Hey there, young man.
Hello,
welcome.
Michael and Jeannie. That
hello,
sounds
hello.
Like a
welcome.
Wonderful time next week. Can you hear me okay?
You're loud and
hello?
Clear.
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful. Sounds like a great time that y'all have planned next week. We wish you very well. And
thank you.
Thank you for sharing that story. Yes, thank you for sharing that story as a reminder to us big kids at heart. That was touching.
Yes.
Very, very touching. Yes, glad to connect this morning for me, afternoon for y'all. And I'd like to ask if we can talk about the reality management worksheet.
Let's go for it.
Let's go.
You've got the floor, sir.
Thank you. I have shared your work even amongst friends, even a few. And even though I don't know it well, I'm very blessed by it. And talking to others about it, one may be on the call today And this question came to being because she was asking me about the reality worksheet. And I realized I need to know more about this. I've done it. I've done it a few times, but I don't really understand it. And certainly did not want to lead anyone with the wrong impressions. So I invited them to join. And I'm going to learn more. They'll learn more. We'll all learn more. So that's a little bit of background. And, Michael, I'd like to ask if we can review. Thank you. I'd like to ask if we can review when to use this worksheet. I've got in my mind when we get triggered or angry by a situation in life. Would you expound a little bit on that, please?
Really? Now, let me ask you a question. So a situation in your life can make you angry? Is that what I just understood you to say? Really?
Yes, I'm trying to.
You know, I didn't know that was possible. I'll have to check in on that.
Yes. Work
so let me give
my
you
corner,
a.
I can tell you.
No, it doesn't work worth a damn. I promise you, it never will. It keeps us in a cycle, and it points up how subtly our minds work to keep things hidden. So now you give me some history from your side. Let me give you some history on the worksheet itself. I was first introduced to the first century Aramaic idea of forgiveness about 43 years ago now. And I was introduced by a gentleman, a giant of a man named Daniel McDougall. Dan was an attorney in Albany, Georgia. He was from a fairly wealthy Atlanta family and had been a very successful real estate attorney, made some money. And a friend of his, who was a Superior Court judge, you've heard me speak of him before, Asa D. Kelly, wanted something to be able to offer in the prison system. And he went looking. And one of the things that I can remember Dan saying to me over and over and over again was how, as he inquired and as he looked for, how do we resolve the insanity going on within the prison system and, of course, by extension, within the world, one of the things he did was he had an interaction with a man from British intelligence. And this man from British intelligence said, if you can find something that you can take into the prison system to cut recidivism, you'll have the answer. So Dan started to work with the first century Aramaic idea of forgiveness. And he actually created a course called EMI, Emotional Maturity Instruction. And with EMI, and then when Dan and I met, we had been traveling parallel roads. He'd been working with the first century Aramaic language and actually guided a group of 25 of the world's top Aramaicists in working to establish the first century meanings of the words of Yeshua, the man who's popularly known as Jesus, but it is not his name in any way, shape, or form. If you break down the word Jesus, you've got Hail Jesus, which, you know, if you were going to take a rabbi to the Greco-Roman world, you probably weren't a very popular person. And so they looked for a name that they could call this rabbi named Yeshua, and they came up with Jesus, which translates Hail Zeus. Everybody knew the Greek god Zeus, so he became pretty palatable. And that was the beginning point. When I first started to work with this, there was a rather primitive worksheet, and between Dan's work and my work, we'd been traveling a parallel road working with the Aramaic language, and I more from the health side, his more from the prison side. Actually, there was a point where Dan, his wife and family were in such hostility at the fact that he turned his attention away from making, you know, being a fountain of money in the real estate business to working and investing in what it took to create or reduce recidivism in the prison system, his family actually tried to have him committed as a result of the fact that he turned his wealth and his intelligence. By the way, he was a naval officer in World War II, and when the Navy did IQ tests on their officers, he was number 4 in the U.S. Navy during World War II in IQ tests. He was pretty amazing. So we started to combine our work, and eventually, as a result of that, emotional maturity instruction was eliminated, and it became laws of living. I had been teaching a course that I had developed called Lessons in Living, actually, that I took to children and such. And so when we combined EMI and Lessons in Living, it became Laws of Living. And with that course, we cut recidivism in the jails and the prisons by over 90%. And actually, the Aramaic translations were not considered valid until those translations could be taken into the classroom and produce the result that they purported to produce, and that would be a mind that would be fueled and motivated by love. So there's a little bit of the history of the worksheet. And if you don't get the worksheet the first or the second or the 10th or the 100th or the 1,000th time that you do it, then you're in good company. At least I'll consider myself good company here. The worksheet that you're looking at, the 7-step that we use currently, the first version of that, as I said, it was rather crude back then. It was about 43 years ago. And I haven't tracked exactly how many edits were done, but there were days. The Why Is This Happening to Me Again workshop, which presented that worksheet process, there were days where I did that workshop as often as 3 times in one day. And that worksheet would go through 5, 6, 7 major edits in one day. So you're looking at version probably at least 2024 of that worksheet. And it wasn't until I had worked with the forgiveness process for close to 35 years, and I'm talking about full time. I mean, again, you know, there's one particular time I was traveling, and the city of Tucson, Arizona hired me to come in and teach to city workers. That was one Why Is This Happening to Me Again workshop, and they wanted the group separate. And that's a 3-hour workshop. And so I did one for city workers, and then I did one for police, and then I did one for fire and emergency personnel. So that's how often that workshop was taught and how engaged I was with it. And it took me 35 years to really comprehend and to be able to explain why and how such an absolutely ridiculous thing as looking at a perfectly wonderful goal that you hold in a situation where there's disturbance or upset, why forgiveness would look like canceling that wonderful goal that you hold for whoever it is that is the object of attention that appears to be the cause of what's happening in your mind. Now, why would you do that? And so before we get into the actual worksheet, I'm just going to do a short explanation of what it took me 35 years to learn. One, perception, the world we think we see, we do not see with our eyes. The world tells us, and you know, 99.999% of the world believes that we have a set of eyes, and our eyes show us an accurate picture of what is happening in the world. Well, my background's in physics, electronics, besides studying physics. And here's what I know. Antennas are one-way valves. In this case, the eye is an antenna that brings light energy, information, into the mind. And we've been tricked into thinking that we can accurately say, and then I see what happened out there. But this antenna that receives information, being a one-way valve, means that we don't see out of the eye what's out there. The information that comes into the eye resonates content in the individual mind. And there's a time delay, if I remember correctly, it's about 7/10,000ths of a second before the brain generates the picture that it sees. I'll help everybody to anchor that thought with a little story that happened with my granddaughter a few weeks ago. She was wanting to watch an anatomy and physiology video, which she's at four, just enamored. At three, was an enamored, would sit for 30, 40 minutes watching a YouTube video on anatomy and physiology. And a few weeks ago, she was making some Play-Doh parts of the human body. She likes to make the kidneys and the bladder and the intestines and the stomach and the esophagus and place it in this doll, this model of the human body that she has. And she was doing that, and she said, "Papa, I want to watch the anatomy video." And I said, "Okay, sweetie, let's go." And I go and turn on YouTube, and we find the video. And it's an animation of a cartoon-like character with all the organs, you know, inside of the body. And the organs all fall out of the body onto the ground as the video starts, in order of size, the smallest organs first. And then each organ sings a song to you to tell you what its part is. So this is a kid's educational piece on anatomy and physiology. When it's the eye's turn to sing, they sing a song. And the song goes, "I am your eyes, I am your eyes, I see the world around you." And Aria looks at me and says, "Papa, they don't understand. We don't see with our eyes, we see with our brain."
Wow.
So a fraction of a second after information comes into the eye generates a construct called perception. And the thing that drives or controls the picture that our brain generates, the construct our brain generates, is the goals that we hold. Now, there's some interesting Harvard research that says that in a time frame where 10,000 brain cells are firing, the max amount of data that goes into conscious awareness in that time frame, which is about a 25th of a second, is 9 bits of data. So we metaphorically, not meaning to be absolutely literal, but I metaphorically call that the 9-bit mind. Each of us is looking through a 9-bit mind. There are approximately 10,000 bits of data resonating within us in that time frame that our brain generates based on 9 bits of data. The world that we think we see out there, but is really being generated within us as a construct, and that construct is driven by the goal that we hold. If we don't have a goal for an object of attention, our brain doesn't give us much information about that particular object of attention. So there can be 1,000 things going on in the environment, but if what we're interested in, you know, somebody's sat and, you know, they've been watching a movie and they're all ensconced in the movie, and something rather dramatic happens right in the room with them, and they do not even perceive it, because not having a goal means there's no attention given to the energy coming in from that, and they missed that thing altogether. Everybody understands that one if they've ever had a conversation with someone, and they're thinking about something else, and this person's explaining something to them, and 20 seconds later, this person says, "Now, did that make sense?" And you go, what was that? What did you say? Nothing was heard because the 9-bit mind was filled with something different. So when I realize that my mind literally generates the world that I experience on every level, and that it does so selectively according to the goals that I hold active at that moment, then I find this genius Yeshua from 2,000 years ago who, and God only knows, and I mean that quite literally, how he understood this, that what we see is driven or controlled by the goal that we hold for whatever object of attention is. And we've developed the language based in projection. And most of the language, as you subtly said, well, those, you know, doing a worksheet on something that makes me angry. You know, my offering is nothing has ever made anyone angry in all of history. But if there is anger in there and I have a goal for an object of attention that that object of attention refuses to fulfill for me, and that object of attention might be you and it might be me, it doesn't matter, whatever that object of attention is, if I hold a goal and I'm not fulfilling it, I'm going to tend to generate perceptual constructs that mean I'm down on myself. And if I have a goal for you and you refuse to fulfill that goal, then I may take my anger and use it to build my brain's image of you. So I'll literally project, I'll build a picture of you out of the unresolved anger in me. And because I now see a picture in my mind and experience a feeling of anger that I've got attached to that picture, I'll really believe that you're the cause of my anger. But again, the truth is nobody's ever been angry with anyone in all of history. But most people who carry anger will find any given object of attention at any moment to be responsible. You made me angry, you made me sad, you made me afraid. So once it's understood that perception is a construct of the mind driven by goals, then the core of the worksheet is to look at and acknowledge honestly what I'm feeling, what my goal is at the moment where I'm experiencing something that's less than love. Then, because healing happens when I take the unresolved parts of my mind that hold rage or fear or sadness or hatred or vengeance or grief or condemnation or gossip or slander, when I hold those energetic patterns, and I project them into my brain's image of someone else or myself. That process is always driven by, my perception is driven by, the goal that I hold. So the core of forgiveness is once I recognize the goal that's driving my pain's perception, that my mind massages into a picture that has me believe that my pain's perception is caused by you, I have to cancel that lie that I've so fallen in love with that the pain in my life is everybody else's fault. I have to cancel the driver that keeps perpetuating that lie in my mind. So when I cancel the goal, whatever it happens to be in any given situation, that's driving my projection that you're the reason I'm doing this to myself again, you know, the title of my book, and I really feel blessed that the universe reserved this book title for me, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? Virtually everybody, when they hear that title, gives some kind of a laugh or clenches their jaw and experiences anger because virtually everybody's asked themselves that question. And the reason is because when I load a goal into my mind that causes my mind to pretend that you're the cause of what's happening inside of me, then I have to dissociate from the real cause of what's happening inside of me. I have to formulate, I have to hide the truth and build a picture of how it's all your fault. But of course, in my workshops, I have this, one of my favorite tongue-in-cheek lines is, you'll notice if you've been through it 87 different times with 42 different people, you're the only one that was there every time. It's about you. It's not about whoever the them is. And that healing happens when we can bring the hidden or dissociated part of the mind forward accurately, rather than experiencing our pained content by putting into our brain's image of someone else and believing they're the cause, when I apply forgiveness a la first century Aramaic Yeshua, I cancel the goal that's driving this pain perception. My pain perception collapses into its root. This opens a pathway into the underlying hidden energy. I like to use a visual for that that is kind of from a rather tragic thing that happened in America, but everybody's got this visual burned into their minds. And that is, we all remember when the 9/11 towers went down. And here are these buildings that are dozens of stories tall, and they, in free fall speed, collapsed in on their own footprint. When you cancel a goal, pained perception, just like those buildings, collapse in on their own footprint. When they do, the footprint that has been dissociated from the cause that's been literally inaccessible because we live in denial of it is now open to exposure. And rather than putting that cause into our brain's image of someone else and believing it's about them, we get to experience it directly. And when I can experience something, whether it's mine from my own personal experience or something that has come from my bloodline, from my generations. You might remember in the ancient scriptures they talked about, the quote they gave us. And before I give that quote, remember that in Aramaic the word sin is an archery term that simply means off the mark. If someone fired at the bullseye and missed the bullseye, the scorekeeper would call out sin, off the mark. You missed the mark. And so when one is in denial and dissociation, their mind is off the mark, and that energy that's creating pain is inside of them. But again, the mind uses that hidden information to build our brain's image of someone else, and we can then successfully believe that it's somebody else's fault. But that never leads to resolution of pain. When one cancels the goal that collapses the errant pained perception, the mind's lie, that what I'm experiencing is somebody else's fault, and that perception collapses in on itself, I can access the underlying traumatic energy directly and do that in the presence of active love. So you notice that the step before you cancel your goal, what you do is you tap in experientially to the presence of love. And if love is active and present, and when I talk about love being active and present, I mean the true experience of ourselves as who we are, as active love, our created essence, not the mamby-pamby, mushy love idea of our world that love is sexual athletics or love is laying your head on the chopping block for someone else to take it off and you sacrifice yourself. We're not talking about that. I'm talking about that love as a fact, as a true state of being, is present in our physiology. At the moment we cancel the goal and bring the underlying pained content forward directly, by the very exposure to love, that pained content dissolves. Now, it tends to dissolve in stages. You might remember there's a particular case, I think it was Peter, that asked Yeshua, well, how many of these worksheets do we have to do? How many times do I need to forgive as to my brother? And he says, is seven times enough? Like, if I do seven worksheets around this issue, is that enough? And in Aramaic, what Yeshua answers is, no. Now, the Greeks translate it as 7 times 70. But in Aramaic, it's 77 times 70. How many times will I forgive around any given issue until I've cleaned out my whole genetic history of pain around that given subject? It may be, and if you look at those numbers, 77 times 70, 70 is a number of completion. And when we add that 7 to it, or pardon me, 7 is the number of completion, 0 is infinity. I'm going to do an infinite amount of work around my dissociated pain and my generational patterns of pain. I'm going to do an infinite amount of work until I'm finished with that. So it may take more than 1 or 2 or 10 or 100 worksheets, and I may have to forgive 20 times in a minute until I get out of the habit of projecting my pain onto someone else's image. You know, Carl Jung talks about how we are religious people. Humans are religious naturally, and everybody's got one. I don't care whether you're an atheist or not, it doesn't matter. The atheist religion, generally speaking, is the religion of blame. The easiest alternative to the truth of I'm a creator and I set up what happens in my life and I need to take responsibility and clean up my own mind. The easiest religion is blame. Notice, just listen in the culture, watch the interviews on television for a few news cycles, and you'll notice that the religion of most people is a conversation about blame. That's what they believe in more than anything. The worksheet process takes us back from that conversation, back into adulthood, back into responsibility. And rather than, you know, there's a passage in the scriptures where they're talking to Yeshua, and he says to them, you're like a bunch of little kids in the square. Nan, 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 look what you did to me. And it's time for us to end that and recognize that if I'm experiencing something in my structure, in my mind, in my perception, if I'm experiencing something that's painful, I have a problem, and I've got to stop believing that it's about everybody else. And if I choose to be finished with it, then I'm going to apply first century Aramaic forgiveness. So in a nutshell, that's a little bit of history and an explanation of what the worksheet is about. Does that fit and make sense for you, Michael? And does that leave you with any questions?
Thank you. Michael, thank you for repeating this. I know I've heard it many times. I think you've gone over this with me personally at least once before, and it's becoming clearer. So I really appreciate that. I appreciate the historical aspect of it. I didn't know that part before. Very interesting. And I have a couple quick questions. Gold.
Go for it.
I have asked you before. I'm a little confused on this. For instance,
okay,
at a certain time of the day, you have a program, and people are counting on you to be on that program. So
right,
that is a goal. I'm guessing it's a goal for you, and it would be a goal for me to connect at my time of the day and be able to speak with you. So that's a goal on both parts. Now,
correct.
How does this work? And another side of goals that I see is if I'm expecting my neighbor to do something and he doesn't do it, then that is also a goal, which isn't necessarily a particular moment in time. It's just something we may have spoke about. Now, are all of those examples part of the goals that you are speaking about?
Absolutely. And
okay. The
reason why that's true, And oftentimes we'll have people who try to change the worksheet and change the forgiveness process, and they'll talk about, well, you know, you just have preferences, so it's about preferences, right? It's like, no, it's not about preferences. And the reason for that is because perception as a construct of the mind is driven by goals and not perception. Perception does not create stress. Goals create stress. For instance, let's say, you know, we're going through, we may extend this conversation out until tomorrow to complete this worksheet that we're going to do. We'll see what happens. But let's just imagine a scenario where we get into a really deep worksheet and we step through it, and by the end of the show tomorrow, that worksheet isn't complete. And there, let's say we don't have any other conversation about it, but there's an assumption, let's say, that you might make that on Monday we'll pick it up and do it again, because we've done that with several shows. Well, we'll just pick it up the next show. But here, Jeannie and I are going to take a week's vacation, our first one in 5 years next week. And what she did a lot of work. She went into so that we could cancel our goal to do the radio show next week. She went in. There's a video recording that we did on called Aramaicisms. It's a four-hour live workshop between myself and a fellow named Dale Allen Hoffman, where we talk about the title of it being Aramaicisms, a term that I coined, representing our objective and our work in bringing back the original meanings of Yeshua's Aramaic words. So what Jeannie did is she went in and rendered the video into an MP4, and then she converted the MP4 into an MP3, took the auditory track off of it. And so that four-hour workshop is going to play 1 hour on Monday, 1 hour on Tuesday, 1 hour on Wednesday, 1 hour on Thursday. And then Dr. Tim is going to select, and I think he's going to do a show where he interviewed Dale Allen Hoffman for the fifth day. So we could imagine a scenario where Monday, you know, you maybe expect to finish that worksheet and you call the show. You've got, of course, a goal for me to be there, and I'm not going to be there. Now, what kind of responses might we see? Well, one person might say, oh, he's on vacation. Gene's on vacation. Great. They needed that. It's been 5 years. That's wonderful. Another response might be, why, that SOB. We're in the middle of a worksheet, and he goes and takes a vacation. Who the hell does he think he is? And all kinds of stuff might fly out of one's mouth in response to the fact that, you know, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Michael's not there for support. And, you know, he's been there for 11 years, and here this is the first time we've taken a vacation like this. You could imagine all kinds of things coming up in a person's mind who holds those goals for me. And, you know, when I'm in the middle of a worksheet with someone and we go, okay, we're going to pick that up tomorrow, I have a goal, too, that tomorrow we'll get through that. So I might have to cancel a goal or two on Monday, or guess what? The goal to complete that worksheet is a way that I would create a stress in my mind. And we do a workshop called Getting the Stress You Need, and it's a big focus in our course, Laws of Living, that I was talking about earlier, as the how stress is created. And you can go all around the world, which I have done, and you can look for every stress expert you can find, and you will not find, at least in decades of looking, you will not find one person that can tell you how stress is created. You'll find people can tell you, well, you should breathe, or you should go out for a walk, or you should count to 10, but you won't find, that I know of, anywhere that can tell you how stress is created until you come to Laws of Living in this work. And guess what creates stress? Setting a goal in your mind. That's the cause of all stress. There are no stressful situations. A person who walks into what someone else might call a stressful situation, who doesn't know anything about what's going on and doesn't hold any goals for it, walks into the situation and, well, it's a situation. Doesn't mean anything to them. There's no meaning given by the mind because there's no goal held for it. Well, somebody else is standing there in a fit of rage because the situation isn't going the way they want it to. Goals create stress. Preferences don't create stress. Desires don't create stress. Goals create stress. And the functioning purpose of your mind and my mind and every mind on the planet is to resolve stress. That is, to achieve the goal. There are only two ways to get rid of a stress once a stress is created in the mind. One way is to achieve the goal. The other is to cancel the goal. I remember back in Atlanta years ago, there was a woman who did some work with and did a worksheet with. And in that situation, she was really down on herself for being promiscuous. She shared with me that she had been promiscuous all her life and didn't want to be that way, but just couldn't help herself. And what she touched into in doing the work, the worksheet process, the forgiveness process, was when she canceled the goal that was involved in this whole idea of self-disapproval and being promiscuous, she had a memory come up. And the memory was of being a very young girl, like 3 or 4, and having an uncle that she just deeply, deeply cherished. And the memory was of being that young girl with this cherished uncle and her uncle pushing her away, rejecting her. Now, as far as she remembered, there was never anything sexually inappropriate with him. But what she realized was that she had a goal for the kind of closeness that before she was pushed away, she had with her uncle. And it was just a sweet closeness with this man that she cherished deeply. And for the first time in her life, when she canceled the goal to be close to her uncle, she found herself back in control of her own sexuality and didn't have to jump into bed with every man that she went out with. For the first time in her life, that driver to regain that intimacy disappeared from her life, and she was back in control of her own sexuality. A goal in the mind of a 3-year-old that's never been canceled still enters behavior. You ever watch somebody and you say, God, they're acting like a 3-year-old. Do you know why? Because what's driving behavior at that moment is the unresolved, unfulfilled goal of the child of 3 and the stress created by the activation or the resonance of that goal. And so the core of forgiveness, seeing as how the functioning purpose of the mind is to take all the data that it has and structure a picture, a set of guidance parameters, that if one does what that guidance is, at least theoretically will fulfill that goal. That's the purpose of the mind, is to build a reality to show us how to complete the goals that we hold. The goals that we hold are insane, that our realities are insane. If the goals that we hold come from 2, 10, 20, 50 years ago, they can still be driving our minds and our mouths and our behaviors today. And we go, where did that come from? And what happens, again, when one cancels a goal? And it took 35 years. I understand why the Greeks came up with forgiveness is about how I'm going to let you off the hook for what's happening inside of me because you're my object of attention and I'm in pain, so it must be your fault. But when Yeshua steps in, he says, no, cancel the goal that's creating the stress right now that's driving your perception. And when that collapses, you get to the root of what's really going on. And when you're able to access and remove that energetic trauma, that no longer drives your mind or your life. How many people have done something against their own will and choice to say, oh, no, boy, I did that terrible thing yesterday. You know, this happens a lot with alcoholics. oh, my God, I found out what I did after I'd had those drinks yesterday, and that was so terrible, and I'm never going to do that again. And they mean it. I mean, they're sincerely repentant, and they're never going to do it again. But they don't know the goal that drives their perception under that particular stress. And if they never go in and resolve that, I guarantee, as with, you know, virtually every alcoholic, the next time they're in that situation with that stress, they do that behavior again. And, you know, the spouse says, well, you said you'd never do that again. Well, no. Oh, I this time I really mean it. But if they don't have forgiveness and they don't know how to find that driver in them, and the circumstance activates or resonates that goal past, and it may be a goal that's 10 generations old, they're going to do that behavior until they get to the place where they can collapse into that underlying energetic pattern that creates this behavior prompt that's so insane. Until they can do that and remove it, forgiveness hasn't occurred. So if there's ever a place where one finds themselves out of control of their own behavior, saying, oh my God, I wish I had never done that, better engage in forgiveness, or the next time the circumstances are right. If you don't go in and remove that goal, and it's activated by circumstance, the mind's going to serve out that perception once again. And in, you know, 43 years or so of working with people directly with this worksheet process, one of the most amazing things, you know, I hear you're sharing with some friends, and if you do worksheets with friends, here's something you're going to find just so amazing as you go through it. And I'm talking about, you know, doing this over a period of years, is you are going to be flabbergasted. You are going to be absolutely amazed when you sit with someone and walk them through that worksheet and they cancel that goal, and then all of a sudden, bang, a totally, completely unconscious, foreign, you know, seemingly impossible memory comes forward. And what people drop into, it always amazes me when they engage in forgiveness. What, especially if they're doing the process, sometimes people will say, oh, well, I just do the worksheet in my head. Well, I have a song that I sing to people who do worksheets in their heads. And you might remember it's a Paul Simon song, and it goes like this. Slip sliding away. You know, the nearer your destination, the more you slip sliding away. When we get close to what's at the root of a trauma, we tend to go running in the other direction, expanding our denial and wanting to blame someone else. When one does the worksheet process in writing, and I'm saying this from personal experience, the things that, you know, if we were just doing it in our heads, you can kind of push aside and not pay attention to, you can't do that so well when you're doing it in writing. You have to start writing everything down, and you start paying attention to the subtler thoughts that need to be healed, and that's where the really deep work happens.
This is really something. So when we are in denial or dissociation, that is when we project, we're projecting onto someone else.
Right. There's a cycle. And, you know, you watch that video of why is this happening to me again at 3 hour. And anybody that would like a copy of that, drop us a note. And, you know, I've got an article, actually I'll send you with several links in it. But the latest 3 hour why is this happening to me again video I just did back a few weeks ago. And in the past, that workshop has always been either an audio track CD that people would buy, or a DVD that people would buy, or they'd do it live, and it was always free when I did it live. But we've chosen to take this latest 3 hour why is this happening to me again workshop and make it a freebie, so it's in that article. And so you'll remember at the top of the board that, you know, the first word I usually write on the top of the board in the center is the word deny. And we have a specific definition of denial in this work. Denial is whenever I think or speak as though something outside of me is the cause of what's happening inside of me. So when I say, you made me mad, in essence, I'm giving my mind an instruction. You know, the mind is an evidential device, and the only thing your mind can do is give you evidence of your own BS. And of course, that's belief system. Somebody might have a different reality for those initials, but when I use that, it's belief system. So when I say, you made me mad, now I've been through this mad, again, 87 different times with 42 different people. But if I live in denial of that, I say, you made me mad. And in essence, what I'm saying to my evidential mind, remember, my mind's going to select 9 bits of data out of 10,000 brain cells firing. There might be 9,991 bits of data that show me clearly that this is mine and it's all about me. But when I say, you made me mad, in essence, I'm saying to my mind, mind, I know there's lots of evidence that shows me that I'm responsible for this state of being mad. But you're not allowed to use that data. I want you to hide that data away and show me information that that person over there is responsible for me being mad. Now, if there's no evidence whatsoever in my mind that proves that that person is responsible, my mind will make it up, will hallucinate it. And if you watch somebody, if you've ever had an interaction with someone and they pronounce how you're the problem in their lives, and then you prove totally, completely, logically, and irrefutably that that is incorrect, in an instant, they'll forget that they said that, and they'll come up with another reason why it's your fault. And if you make that illogical and ridiculous as a belief, they'll forget that they told you that piece of lie, and they'll come up with another way of blaming you. And I've watched people do 8 or 10 different, totally different stories around why, you know, trying to prove that it's someone else's fault. And once one lie is shot down, the mind has to hallucinate another. So that's why we have a workshop called Communication. Did you hear what I think I said? Because when we speak projection speak, you made me mad, we're instructing our mind to show me a construct that proves that you made me mad. That's denial. When I deny, when I think or speak as though something outside of me is the cause of what's moving inside of me, I have to dissociate from the real cause. I have to hide it from myself. It's like I've created a file on my computer. I put a password on the file. I closed the file, and I threw the password away. I can never access that file again. In denial and dissociation, the content that would show me that I'm the cause of what's happening to me is now totally and completely out of my control, out of my sight, and out of my awareness. It's locked away and hidden until I find the password. When in that state, and the mind has instructions to make up a way to blame somebody else, then the mind has to use false data to produce its perception, to produce its construct that shows that somebody else is the problem. The password for getting to that dissociated part of the mind is always forgiveness. When I apply first century Aramaic forgiveness, I learn something about myself that I didn't know. I learn what it is that I've dissociated from in my own mind. And when I cancel the goal that drives that whole process and keeps it unconscious, then my perception collapses. And when my perception collapses, I get back to that original true cause. When I bring that forward to conscious awareness in the presence of love, then that content heals. And that is first century Aramaic forgiveness. And the timer on the radio show is telling me, and it's like this is one of the fastest hours I've had in a long time, the timer is telling me we're down to 60 seconds.
You didn't do projection.
Giving my mind instructions to blame somebody else, I'm projecting that content. My mind uses the very data that I've dissociated from to build my brain's image of someone else. And that's how projection works. So projection is taking something that's inside of me and making it look like that something is outside of me. So now I get a picture of you being the cause of what's happening inside of me. And the way that that projection is collapsed is by canceling the goal. And we're running out the clock. We're down to just 10 seconds. So if we can continue this worksheet tomorrow and the questions about it, let's go for it.
Let's do it.
Work for you?
Thank you all so much. Yes, sir. Thank you
very
much. Awesome.
Hey, we're going to separate this one out as a separate show. Great questions. Great conversation. Have a blessed one, my friend.